This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation, as always, on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Follow along at WNPR Wheelhouse. We're joined today, as always, by Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show here on Connecticut Public Radio. Hi there, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky.
Also with us is Mark Pazniokas. He's Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, and you can find him at CT Mirror Paz on Twitter. Hi there, Paz. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
And also joining us today is Harriet Jones. She's Managing Editor for Connecticut Public Radio at WNPR Harriet. Hi there, Harriet.
Good morning.
So much to talk about today, but let's start where seemingly we start everything right now, the big government shutdown. It's in its 33rd day. The U.S. Senate's expected to vote coming up soon on two competing proposals to reopen the federal government. It is unlikely either of these proposals will pass. We've talked a lot about direct impacts of the shutdown on workers who aren't getting paid. But then there are all those federally funded services like food stamps, like the federal courts, all being impacted by what's happening here. And we'll get into a little bit of what we're seeing here in Connecticut in just a moment. But Colin, let me just start with you very quickly. We're seeing more posturing in Washington. It seems likely that this is going to go on for quite some time. We're going to hear from Harriet and Paz a little bit about what some of the big impacts are right now. I don't know. I mean, as we enter a 33rd day of a partial government shutdown, is there anything new that you wake up to, surprised by? Anything else that we can say about this thing that seems a little bit unprecedented in American government history?
Well, yeah, everything. First of all, I want to say that there was a kind of conventional wisdom going into the shutdown to which I unfortunately subscribed, which was that due to sort of post-90s modifications, shutdowns weren't as bad as they used to be. And that appears to have been a faulty assessment. Shutdowns are still really, really bad, and they have ripple effects that, as we're going to discuss, affect all kinds of constituencies. Some people might have heard some reporting on Morning Edition today, based, I think, on some reporting also in The Atlantic about, like, there are federal DOJ agents who can't pay their confidential sources. They were trying to, like, you know, infiltrate gangs and stuff like that, and they don't have the money to pay the sources, and, you know, they can't get on the Joint Terrorism Task Force computers. I mean, it's just a big, big problem. I would say that the other big development is that, you know, this is President Trump's he has no good options anymore. If he backs down in any way from the wall, he loses face with his own constituency. On the other hand, if he clearly owns this thing, you know, he said at the beginning that he would own the mantle of this. Well, he does own it. There's a new polling out this morning that puts his approval rating at 40 and his disapproval rating at 57. 57 is a very high disapproval rating for a president. The shutdown is clearly tied to his tailspin in the polls. But I don't see his way out either. And I think it would bother a lot of presidents who've come before to be presiding over a government that wasn't running for 33 or 34 days. But, you know, he has this kind of Ayn Rand, you know, influenced notion of himself as this solitary hero bucking the conventions and shaking his fist at the sky. And this probably feeds into that quite a bit. So, you know, we could be having this conversation again next week.
I just 2 points quickly before we move on to some of the downstream impacts. A, I don't think that there's any chance that he actually read Atlas Shrugged. Two, I wonder, Colin, if it's true that he risks alienating his constituency, or he risks alienating the constituency of one, like somebody like Ann Coulter. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't know what Ann Coulter's favorability is compared to Donald Trump. She essentially dared him to do this. Could he buck some of the conventional wisdom on the very, very conservative right side of American public and still be able to maintain the rest of his base, a base that likes him for a lot of other things that have nothing to do with what Sean Hannity or Ann Coulter say?
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a hard thing to measure. And I also think that we're poorly positioned to measure that because where that base exists, it's not invisible in Connecticut. There are plenty of people in Connecticut who think we should build that wall. They're in the minority, but they exist. You know, does his base like him for other things? Yes, but he's kind of made this his only bet. I mean, at the moment, he's really not doing anything else as president. One reason for that is that there are a lot of things that just obviously aren't operating. But for example, he has no chief of staff. He has no Secretary of Defense. He has no Secretary of the Interior. He has acting people in some of the other key positions. Outside of, you know, directing Rudy Giuliani's efforts on his behalf vis-a-vis his legal problems.
And he's doing a bang-up job.
Right. And playing this who-blinks-first game about the shutdown, I don't think he's doing anything else. So he's made a big bet on this particular situation.
A thought pass?
Yeah. You have to sort of unwind this. There's the legitimate debate about how the U.S. needs to secure its borders and to the extent to which you need a wall, perhaps not along the entire U.S. border for a whole bunch of reasons, mainly that the experts say it's not necessary. But then you can't separate it from the game of chicken, and that's really what's going on here. And to Colin's point about, you know, is his audience, and your point is, you know, who's his audience? Is it Sean Hannity and Ann Coulter? Because there was a sense that he was not going to go forward with this a month ago. And then he was sort of dared into doing it. And this is the, depending how you keep count, the seventh or eighth time the president has created a crisis to help in negotiations. He's done it several times with tariffs and other trade issues, with our friends, Canada, with South Korea, as well as China and so forth. So this is the Trump way. Larry Kudlow, before he joined the Trump White House, said the Trump style is to knock you in the teeth, get your attention, and then kind of go for a settlement. Well, he's treating the Congress as though they're a contractor who he owes money to in Atlantic City, and they're not quite as easy to roll as some of these guys were, you know, back when he was running casinos.
I'm wondering quickly if you could just maybe give a little handicapping number on something that Colin said. If you were to guess amongst people in Connecticut, Republican voters, people who are actually in the state legislature, I mean— how many people would you guess really, really support the idea of building a border wall? I mean, that in our state that you cover so closely?
Not many. And we're seeing an indication of that in what happened in the General Assembly yesterday. They did a nice thing for federal employees who are going without pay. But underlying that gesture of implementing legislation that allows these banks to quickly provide loans backed by the state— beneath that is a jab at the president. Interestingly, West Hartford, where I live, hours after the General Assembly passed that bill and the governor signed it, an element of that is allowing cities and towns to waive penalties on late payments for property taxes. West Hartford did that within hours of passage. And again, it's a gesture to federal employees who live in town, although how many of them, who knows.
Yeah.
But it's also the political point. Mr. President, we don't agree with you. So you're going to see, I think, more and more of these gestures, both concrete and symbolic, to distance, to make clear that there is not approval of this approach.
So, Harriet, you in the newsroom here have been following really closely so many of the downstream impacts, whether it's TSA workers or Coast Guard employees, the school down there, and all of the federal money that's supposed to be flowing into various programs. Where do you want to start? I mean, where do you see the biggest impacts right now?
Well, yeah, I mean, almost as if this were a theoretical exercise, it would be a fascinating way to expose the ways in which the federal government does impact our lives, which we normally are not all that aware of. I mean, apart from people who are literally paid by the federal government, obviously Coast Guard employees, TSA workers, and so forth, that the impact is first on them. But now we're beginning to see, as we get into a month and more of the shutdown, other people, you know, sounding warning alarms saying, you know what, if this goes on much longer, this really is going to have effects on many people. And, you know, it's striking to me how many of them are people who don't have a very large voice in this. I mean, many Coast Guard members have said they're reluctant to speak to us for a start because it's not particularly done for military members to be speaking up in the media about their treatment. Colin was mentioning DOJ employees, that kind of work that goes on behind the scenes. That's not something you'd normally hear about or that people would speak out about. And also with people like, you mentioned the Prudence Crandall Center that we visited yesterday, which is a shelter for victims of domestic violence. They're now saying they get, I think it's $45,000 a month from HUD to pay their rent, literally, to keep the doors open. And they're saying if this goes to the end of February, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know whether we're going to be able to meet those bills. And again, those are people who, you know, perhaps are not very obvious in the media in normal times, don't normally have a voice. So we're seeing these kinds of impacts now coming with this, you know, shutdown being the longest in history, we're beginning to see the ways in which it might impact, you know, many of us.
Yeah, we're reading in the Connecticut Mirror, Mark's colleague Anna Radilat, you know, says that state and municipal governments depend on billions of dollars from Washington to run dozens of other programs. That includes federal transit money, housing money, funds for nutrition, law enforcement, and criminal justice programs, which already have dried up or will dry up soon. And so this really is showing up in a variety of ways, Harriet. And I think that the other key thing is when you go and talk to the folks at the domestic violence shelter about something that really won't impact them unless this goes a little bit further. Nobody really thought, as Colin said, that this was going to go longer than a week or two. Now it's a month. It's a continued standoff. There's really no end in sight. And we can start to see more things coming in the next month.
Right. And, you know, it gets to be a kind of a circular thing, too. The TSA representative was saying this week, well, TSA employees have been told, well, you can apply for food stamps, which she said was, you know, in and of itself kind of a slap in the face.
Yes.
But then she said, you know what, in about another month, they won't be able to apply for food stamps because that won't be funded, you know?
Yeah.
And her line, which I thought was a great one, was, you know, we've been told we'll get back pay eventually. Well, we can't eat eventually.
And, you know, the other aspect of this is the impact on the economy. You know, there are estimates that it could be a half point. You know, loss of economic growth or up to a full point. And of course, one of the great ironies in this is that we won't know precisely because the people who measure such things at the U.S. Commerce Department, they're not there.
So we're just going to be guessing at how bad the economic impact is. We're not going to have food stamps to help people who should already have jobs. We've got people missing payments. When you were telling the story about the DOJ folks unable to ply people with money, confidential informants, there's also that you know, tricky problem, which is if DOJ employees don't make their car payment or their house payment, they very well could lose their job because they're checked having to do with their credit rating. So there's a lot of stuff. If this goes another month, Colin.
Yeah. Fortunately, CBS is launching NCIS Shutdown, which basically the cast just sits around doing nothing. You know, it's like you can't do anything. So, you know, I want to go back to something that Harriet said. First of all, I want to do a shout out to one of our reporters, Frankie Graziano, who's been all over this story, these stories about the kind of ripple effect from the shutdown. But this maybe sort of goes a little bit to also Ned Lamont's task in Connecticut. One of the reasons that people hate government, if they hate government, and a lot of people say they hate government, is that they don't know what it does or they don't think about what it does. And I've said, I think, a few months ago, the smartest thing Ned Lamont could do would be a series of PSAs where he kind of explains how we benefit from the existence of government programs. And I think you're seeing this now, too. People who – you might hate the federal government, but guess what? This is – you remember that documentary, A Day Without a Mexican, that actually showed what all the labor that comes in from this over the southern border actually does in America. This is kind of the government equivalent of that. What happens when you don't have the government anymore? A lot of bad things happen when you don't have the government anymore.
You don't have the government inspecting food. You don't have the government checking bags. We haven't really seen the types of massive slowdowns, Harriet, at, say, Bradley International Airport here. But we don't have an airport as big as, you know, Atlanta, where they're seeing already problems and they have the busiest airport in the entire world going through. Over the course of a longer period of time, TSA workers not getting paid is going to mean a lot of travel delays exacerbated by winter weather.
Right, it is. And, you know, that's been suggested as one of the kind of the pinch points, maybe one of the points of leverage that federal workers might have is if the TSA decided they weren't going to come to work, if they, you know, maybe did something like a sick out, that could be something that, you know, really does put pressure for this to come to an end.
So Ned Lamont struck a deal with banks in order to get some loans put out. Is there anything else that the state legislature can do or the governor can do at this point, Paz, to try to, you know, head off some of the big problems that we see coming down the pike if we expect this to go on longer?
You mean using all the vast resources of the state?
Well, I mean, sure.
Well, look, that's the other larger question. At some point, you know, at what point do the federal payments to the state? Because remember, the state of Connecticut, every state gets lots of federal money. For Medicaid and other things. And as this goes forward, the question is, what are the tipping points? When do the results, the consequences ripple out even further than they are now? And that, you know, at what point do cities and towns don't have the funding to go forward on some basic services? The focus has been on the 800,000 federal employees, but there's also 4 million contractors that aren't getting paid. Mm. They have employees who they may or may not be paying. So again, this ripples out, and I think it can move exponentially quicker if this goes another month.
Colin, before we take a break, you put a note in the document that I think is important to note. This time of year, between the holidays and this time when it's very, very cold outside, we do talk a lot about getting services to the neediest individuals in our community. Food banks get an awful lot of food out to people, and increasingly it's going out to people who just are out of work right now or aren't getting paid. We lost somebody who's very important in the world of getting food to the needy, Gloria McAdam, just recently.
Yeah, she died about a week ago. She was a lioness on behalf of FoodShare. FoodShare is facing, as Harriet alluded, FoodShare is facing a problem too, which is that there's money that comes to them, I believe from the Department of Agriculture, that creates some of their budget to buy food. So I think there's some reserve in the SNAP program that might get them through February, but ultimately they're going to hit a wall too. I guess what I would sort of say in honor of Gloria, who really was a great person and just gave her whole life to this program, is, I don't know, this morning, I'm violating the rule of Maimonides by saying this, but I'm hoping to inspire people. I made very modest donations this morning to FoodShare and to the Prudence Crandall Center. And that's not a good solution. I mean, ultimately, we need a functioning federal government. We're already paying taxes that are supposed to go to these things. But the other reality is, as you say, winter is here. It's not just coming, it's here. And people have some basic needs. And so if you're listening right now and that's in your heart and you can think of lots of other places. So these nonprofits that are now feeling the second wave of the shutdown, and you could find a little donation to make to them, might help make February anyway a little less uncomfortable.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about the revenues generated by UConn sports programs. Well, maybe revenues in the opposite direction. They're on the decline, let's just say. UConn being subsidized more than just about any other school in Division I. We got a new president coming in and a new governor. Are things going to change? We're talking with Colin McEnroe, with Harriet Jones from WMPR, also with Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Harriet Jones, managing editor for Connecticut Public Radio, Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, and also Colin McEnroe, who hosts The Colin McEnroe Show. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, our producer, Josh Nalea, who because of some – well, he claimed it was from medical issues. He's had to cut back for a while. The work that he's doing. He's a very, very creative producer. But we've also discovered that he's become addicted to the board game Go, which is a very, very ancient and mathematically complicated. And I sort of think that might be one reason he's not around as much anymore.
He's playing Go a lot?
But he's producing an entire show today about board games, including new board games that are interesting and fun, and are the board games for about 10 years have been having a little bit of a renaissance anyway. But we're also going to do a segment on Go, on which Josh will not appear. Because he's playing Go.
Another very complicated segment on the Colin McEnroe Show coming up today at 1 o'clock. Hope you can join us for that. Before we move on, I just wanted to close the loop on our conversation from the last segment we were talking about. Food pantries opening up, including as we've seen, Harriet, not just here in Connecticut, but elsewhere in the country. We had a report on one from Boston. Food pantries opening up for Coast Guard employees, for people working at the Coast Guard.
Right. And that has kind of been a fairly visceral reaction in southeastern Connecticut, because kind of everybody knows a Coastie down there. You know, they're so integrated into the community. They're such a part of the fabric of the community down in southeastern Connecticut. My kids go to school beside Coast Guard kids. Two of my kids are taught music lessons by Coast Guard band members. You know, people serve on nonprofit boards with Coast Guard members. It's just the impact is huge down there. And to see uniformed military members standing in line at a food pantry. And these are people who, not only have given their lives in public service, but they risk their lives in public service, some of them. I heard a story from this weekend from somebody in the Coast Guard who has a relative who's on a sub. He's in the Navy. He had a medical problem, had to be medevaced off the sub. And he was saying, please don't send the Coast Guard for me. I don't want the Coast Guard to come for me because I know they're not getting paid. So, you know, there's a real kind of visceral reaction there down there of people who, you know, these are people that they know. And it's terrible to see them standing in lines at food pantries.
Well, and I think an awful lot of the American public did not understand, and probably still does not understand until this shutdown, that the Coast Guard, while they are a part of the military infrastructure of the nation, they're not a part of the Department of Defense and the gigantic, unstoppable budget that they have. They're part of the Department of Homeland Security, which is funded in a different way, has somewhat different tasks, but is also engaged in the defense of the country.
Absolutely. And interestingly, so they're trying to pass a bill in Congress to backstop Coast Guard pay and have them treated in the same way. So they do get paid through DHS, which is why they're not paid during a shutdown. This bill is trying to, you know, kind of ring fence Coast Guard pay and have them treated in the same way in a shutdown. And there are some members in Congress who are saying, yes, but we want to take out of that the civilians who work for the Coast Guard. And that's a point of conflict on that bill. So it looks like that bill may not pass.
All right. So my connective tissue from that into this next thing that we want to talk about, Paz, is that something else is very prevalent in southeastern Connecticut. A lot of people know people who work at casinos, and casinos are very big business there, and they're very big business here in our state. And we've been talking for quite some years now about whether or not we're going to expand casino gambling and have more casinos elsewhere, maybe north of Hartford, maybe in Bridgeport. Well, we've got a new-looking legislature. We've got a brand-new governor. What's changed in that whole equation about expanded casino gambling?
You are Mr. Segway, aren't you?
That's why I get paid the huge money, Paz.
Yeah. So there is I don't think Netflix is interested yet, but there's this great miniseries in Connecticut that's entering its fifth season. Unfortunately, you can't binge watch and see how it all ends because I would have done that. It is literally in its fifth year, this fight over the expansion of casino gambling, who will control it, as well as a relatively new issue, sports gambling. These things politically are hopelessly intertwined. You've got the two federally recognized tribes on one side facing off against MGM on the other side. And it is incredibly complicated. You have proposals for two new casinos off tribal lands. The tribes want to build in East Windsor to compete with MGM Springfield. MGM says it wants to build in Bridgeport, which was a way to get a lot of political support in the General Assembly from urban legislators. You know, they are a very smart company. They propose in Bridgeport. They say they would do hiring for Bridgeport and New Haven, so that instantly gave them this great urban coalition. So the result of that in the General Assembly has been something of a stalemate. Now, some of the developments more recently, is there still an economic rationale to build a smaller casino in East Windsor, fight the tribes, because—
Great question.
Yeah, well, it's going to cost $300 million. And by the way, the return on investment wasn't to increase the revenue to the state of Connecticut and the tribes. It was to blunt the loss of revenue to Springfield. Well, Springfield is turning out not to be as big a deal as they had feared. The Office of Policy and Management, which does budget forecast, originally forecast that the slots revenue that Connecticut gets in its, let's face it, it's a partnership with the tribes, that it was going to fall from $263 million down to $203. Well, they've revised that number upward twice. And now they're saying, yeah, we're still going to get maybe $248 million. Now, that doesn't mean the tribes aren't facing real competitive pressures. There's going to be a huge casino opening in Boston or just north of Boston in Everett sometime this year. And that's going to be a huge problem. But anyway, this is just a sense of the complications. Oh, and oh, by the way, MGM's interest in Bridgeport. Well, MGM last year, and they just closed the deal, they purchased the Yonkers Raceway, which is also the site of the Empire City Casino. So they just spent $850 million for a casino down I-95. Are they really committed to spending another, you know, $600 million in Bridgeport?
So there's a bunch of stuff in there, Colin. I'll go to you first. the specter of a Bridgeport casino is something that we've been talking about in the state for a very, very long time. The idea of one that's north of Hartford, south of Springfield, is a much newer construction. From the early returns, if MGM Springfield isn't doing all that well, maybe there's not anywhere near the appetite for gambling in this 91 corridor that anyone thought, and maybe building another casino could just be a gigantic flop. So this is some new information that we didn't have before, I suppose.
Right. I mean, first of all, Paz wrote a really great story about this, but my head hurts just thinking about all this stuff because it's not just casinos, and I hope we have time to talk about that too. I think there are a lot of questions that are difficult to resolve, although maybe you, Paz, you may know the answer to this. One question that I have about – first of all, let me just say, apropos of what you just said, John, look, the handles are shrinking. The handle, which is the total amount of money bet at – on any particular activity. The handle's been shrinking at our casinos here in Connecticut for quite some time. And I think it's pretty clear in another way, as you just suggested, that there probably isn't as much gold in them thar hills as everybody had assumed. This experience up in Springfield seems to point to that too, that, I mean, these are companies that are presumably run by reasonably smart people and extremely greedy people, and they think that they can make some money with all this expansion. But they can't make as much money as originally had been supposed, which means that the state's take from that is probably not going to be as big as had been supposed. But Paz, one thing that I notice is there's all these different kind of competing constituencies at the legislature, and including a number of legislators who basically think everything has to go through the tribal compact. Like if they had their way, you know, our Super Bowl pool in the office would go through the tribal compact, you know. And I sort of wonder about that. I mean, I know certain things have to go through. But there's, for example, the whole sports betting thing. It has been suggested, I think, by some of the legislators that the tribes would have to get a bite out of that or be offered it or they should run it. Can you shed a little
sure,
light on that?
Sure. So the question is the exclusivity that the state of Connecticut has granted to the two tribes. The state of Connecticut – ironically enough, when Weicker was governor, he hated casino gambling. He tried to stop the tribes from building those casinos by repealing the old Las Vegas Knights because the way federal law works, federally recognized tribes can offer any gambling that a state otherwise offers, even if it's only, you know, the parochial school Las Vegas Knight. That was the hook for the tribes to open those casinos. So Weicker cut this brilliant deal. We'll allow you to do slots, which you couldn't otherwise do. But you're going to pay us 25%. What that did – and we're going to grant you exclusivity. And what that did was it set a price to enter the Connecticut market if you're a commercial casino operator. Remember, at the height, the tribes were paying the state $430 million a year. So if Wynn wanted to come in, if Trump wanted to come in, if anybody else wanted to come in, they had to basically make the argument, we can beat that number. And nobody could. But now with all the competition, that number's falling. When Boston opens, it probably will fall to $200 million or even lower. At that point, what is the value of the exclusivity? So to Colin's question, the tribes are saying sports betting is a casino game. Now, why? Well, because the first place it was offered legally was in Las Vegas casinos. Does that make it a casino game? You can argue that in court. So the question is, can the state of Connecticut, without negotiating an amendment to the gambling compacts with the tribes, can they offer sports betting? And that's an open question. Now, the state has some leverage here. The tribes need it a hell of a lot more than the state does. This is not huge revenue for the state of Connecticut. The estimate has been as low as $20 million, as high as $40 or $50 million. But the tribes need it to compete. They want the foot traffic. They want sports gamblers to come in, you know, do some betting and then wander around the casino. The other aspect that gets very, not complicated, but is a little bit more controversial is, do you offer this stuff online? The real money for this, as much as 75%, is the ability to place bets on your iPhone in the middle of a game, doing in-game bets. That's where the money seems to be.
So, Harriet, one of the big arguments with all of this considered is that, as Colin suggested, the handle from the two existing casinos has been shrinking over time. There's sort of a rethinking about the numbers of jobs, the amount of revenue. I mean, how does that look? How does the existing casino infrastructure that we have right now in southeastern Connecticut, how exactly is it looking as we look to some sort of expansion?
Right. I mean, I think what Colin was describing before, you know, is known in the business as market saturation, right? And nobody quite knows where that point is, where you have so many facilities that you've run out of gamblers to go and spend their money there. And, you know, the tribes have somewhat recognized this in recent years, and they've been diversifying away from gambling. They've been offering all kinds of other things and building out different kinds of experiences that you can have at their properties. So they, you know, I guess emphasize the resort aspect of you know, going to the casino. But there are so many other unknowns, I think. I was struck by the quote you had from Ned Lamont in your piece, "I just want to get something done," which, you know, good luck, because, I mean, it's almost like the rules are changing, or we don't know what the rules are. And that was pointed out by, you know, the difficulty that the two tribes had in this last year trying to get these compacts amended to get the East Windsor Casino up and running, because all kinds of things changed at the BIA. And one tribe got its amendment, the other tribe didn't. So that whole thing just points out to us how many different competing constituencies there are and how much of this is going on behind closed doors and how we are not sure what the rules are, in fact.
Yeah, we're not at all sure what the rules are. And I, very quickly before we move on, Paz, the role that sports betting plays in this, it seems pretty clear that it's incredibly important. Is that really what it comes down to? I mean, because there is so much money, as Colin said, maybe not so much money in the traditional casino, slots parlor, north of Hartford in Emthar Hills. But if you've got a different sort of gambling opening up that's only going to be at your local casinos, now all of a sudden it's a little different sort of thing.
Yeah, and it's the interest in the sports betting is because it's new. It's a new market. And to Harriet's point about it, we are seeing saturation on casino gambling. But, you know, the groups interested in sports betting, they include the Connecticut Lottery. They include SportTech, which is the vendor for off-track betting in Connecticut. You have Caesars, which has no presence in Connecticut. They just hired a couple lobbyists in case sports betting is legal. And, of course, MGM. They, you know, the big gambling entities, they have the databases to do the sports betting, because this is, you know, these are mini economies, you know, and the bets they offer. I went to a workshop months ago, and it's fascinating, the bets that are offered, the in-game bets, again, which is the hot thing. And I'm guessing if it's an NFL game, you'll be able to bet on how many blown calls there'll be in the Super Bowl.
And hi. Can I just say one thing?
Please.
You know, there are pending investigations right now of Ryan Zinke, the former Secretary of the Interior. One of them involves these issues and involves allegations that he lied to investigators from his own department about what was happening. One of the things that appeared to have been happening was that he was getting pressure, not just from MGM, but from Nevada congressmen, apparently maybe on behalf of MGM. And the reason the Department of Interior, just so we're clear, is involved in any of this, because it doesn't involve like elk or anything, but it does involve Native American tribes. Bureau of Indian Affairs is inside the department. And it's one of those indications that this whole world of gambling, surprise, surprise, doesn't really lead to elevated behavior in the world of government. It leads to, you know, deplorable things.
Well, and just very quickly to that point, Brian on Twitter asked us, when can we finally start talking about careers and not just jobs? Casinos have a lot of jobs, but how many people earn a living wage or get health insurance? I don't know, Harriet.
Well, there is
a question.
Yeah, actually, a lot.
Yeah.
And there are people who've been worked in the casinos for two decades and actually really like their jobs. So, I mean, was it lower wage? I think, you know, the casinos came along at a time when EB was kind of bleeding jobs, and these were for sure lower wage jobs than you would have found at EB, but they have sustained an economy down in the southeastern of the state.
We're going to turn into something else where perhaps the state of Connecticut has bet big on collegiate sports. Over the course of time, the UConn Huskies became a very, very popular men's and women's basketball program, generated revenues. They added football quite some time ago, but they were not able to cash in on one of the top five conferences, and that has meant big problems. Colin, we see reports now that UConn, $80 million in expenses, and, you know, they're taking about half of that money directly from the state. They're subsidizing their sports programs because they're just not making enough money. And that's the biggest deficit in all of Division I sports. You've been railing for quite some time about whether or not UConn is actually in the right businesses when it comes to sports. But it seems like these new numbers put your argument into pretty stark relief right now.
Well, unlike Paz and Harriet, I try to do as little reporting as I possibly can. But
good for
occasionally,
you. Good for you.
Occasionally, I go down one of these rabbit holes. And so for a number of years, I haven't done it so much lately. I was really fly-specking these budgets, trying to figure out, you know, does the UConn sports pro department break even? Do they lose money? Do they make money? And, of course, a lot of things are said in a kind of posturing basis. And Jim Calhoun's famous not one dime back when he was asked if he would give any of his salary back to UConn at a time when it was hurting. I think it is pretty clear right now. No, these are not – I mean, even UConn women's basketball, which is, I think, the most revered and sanctified of the programs, according to ESPN's analysis of this, is losing money too. So, yeah, I feel like, I don't know, I don't want to sound petulant, but getting straight answers out of UConn about this has been a very, very difficult process, probably almost as difficult as dealing with big gambling interests. I mean, and the way that these costs are accounted for in the budget, including just, you know, stuff like debt service on some of these big practice facilities and stuff, it's really hard to figure out what these programs cost. But I think we kind of have an answer right now. They are the most subsidized by their university sports department in America, in Division I.
You mentioned, though, it's hard to get information out of people with big gambling interest. The difference is, and you pointed this out earlier, is that the casino business is run by very, very smart people who've made billions of dollars running casinos, and we know exactly what they're trying to do. We understand why they're cagey about it, because they're in the business of trying to make tons of money and trying to get us to pay for it. The question is, when you got a public institution that is not giving us that information, it's a little bit of a different thing than maybe Caesars not telling us something about a Las Vegas casino.
Right. And this will transition into some good stuff for Harriet and Paz, too, because I think one of the other questions about this is, to what degree does UConn really exist under the oversight of the state legislature or the governor? You know, Paz has been reporting on Ned Lamont's considerations about who the new president is going to be. But it's unclear to me that there's the kind of direct oversight on UConn, because they also have obviously a board of trustees, that there might be on another kind of state agency. Like, can the legislature and the governor really get answers and kind of crack the whip on UConn the way they can on other stuff? And I always feel like there's kind of a little layer over UConn that keeps some of the ordinary supervision out.
Paz, go.
Yeah, UConn. UConn has an outside presence at the state capitol and in the state in general. I guess not surprising, you have a state this size, that its public university, its flagship university, would play that role. But a couple of things. You know, the idea that an athletics department should make money or break even, you know, this is a new thing. And it grew out of the chase for the dollar, for the TV contracts, the push to get Connecticut into a so-called power division. So in the old days, this was just considered a good activity for students to play sports. Those days are long, long gone. There are some people who say, well, if Connecticut can just get into one of the power conferences, all these problems will go away. And I would urge people to look at Rutgers, you know, one of the former Big East schools that was invited into the Big Ten. They were either the 13th or 14th team invited into the Big Ten.
Look, math isn't the strong point at any of these schools, Bass.
But, you know, you look at the experience of Maryland and Rutgers in particular in the Big Ten. It has been a disaster. It has been a disaster as far as the experience for the athletes on the teams, for the student bodies. These teams are getting crushed. The revenue's not there. So my point is, even if UConn can get into one of these conferences, it doesn't mean all these financial problems will go away. So the question is, will anybody in Connecticut, whether it be Governor Lamont or anybody on that board, will take a hard look at what should be the role of football at the University of Connecticut. Now, I say that as somebody who is a graduate of Boston University, a team that got rid of football in the 90s, and apparently has done okay since then.
Yeah. I just want to quickly say that University of Maryland, which you mentioned, in concert with Rutgers University, joined the Big Ten. It's not gone well since then, but actually Maryland's problems with football date back before that, when Randy Etzel left the UConn football program and in the middle of the night. left UConn holding the bag, and then sort of drove the Maryland football program into the ground. But he's back. He's the coach of UConn once again, presiding over this sort of disastrous problem that we have right now.
He is, but I'll tell you, the problem is bigger than Randy Edsall. The problem is bigger than the performance on the field. It's the extent to which sports has become the tail that wags the dog. And that's, I think, the larger debate at UConn. Now, Connecticut's new governor has interviewed the two finalists for president and did not quickly sign off on either of them. You know, Lamont has his own ideas about the role UConn needs to play as far as preparing students for the workforce, for working with Connecticut's employers. So that's a slowly unfolding story. We'll see where Lamont wants to go with that.
But that's so interesting, Harry, because it really does get into the future of the flagship university of the state. Susan Herbst, when she would sit with us and talk about the things that UConn could and should be known for, is a big research university drawing students from all over the world that was in many ways disconnected from the educational pathway for many kids who grew up in Connecticut. That's something that UConn used to be, that it's not so much anymore, and it was also going to excel at sports. More people know about UConn around the country and around the world because of Jim Calhoun and Gino Auriemma, not so much Randy Edsall. But I think that the important point to this is this new president has to look at what kind of UConn are we going to have? Is it a flagship school for a state? Is it a gigantic research university that is disconnected from that? Is it a big sports powerhouse?
Right, and I think that points to the point about what is sports for? And I'll admit to being the dummy on this issue because I didn't go to school in this country. I went to school in a country where, you know, universities, there's a certain segment of students who do sports because it's good for them and it's fun. You know, it's that kind of dynamic.
You played hurling in college.
Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, field hockey. weird stuff. Yeah, but you know, so this kind of culture of big sports and big money in sports is kind of a little foreign to me. But I said jokingly to Colin yesterday, but I think there might be a grain of truth here, that if they were winning, if UConn football was successful, we may not be talking about this right now, even if they were losing as much money. I'm not sure, you know, I think you can probably win and lose money and not be quite as controversial.
I think that there's some truth to that, Colin.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of variables, almost all of which are working against UConn right now. And to go back to something in the past said, I mean, the TV revenues really are a problem. Being in a less glamorous conference, I mean, really one of the big businesses that college sports is in is the TV business. You're in the TV business, and the revenues over there, because nobody cares about this conference that UConn is in, are falling fast. Yeah, the program itself is a mess, and it's just not supervised the way even any other part of the university is. I mean, you all often be paying multiple coaches, head coaches of football or basketball at the same time. If you were paying, you know, three different people to teach the same literature course, you know, that would be regarded as kind of a budget problem.
And I think that to Harriet's larger point, we have papered over and done an awful lot of public policy based over the years on one simple argument, which is go Huskies. I mean, I think that people love basketball.
Right. So if you can't say go Huskies, what are they there for? What are they helping with? And I think at a time when, you know, tuition is going up, and, you know, you were saying it's harder and harder for people from Connecticut to go to UConn because it's getting
very
less and less
so
affordable.
And it's become more selective. It's not
right
about getting kids who grew up in Pomfret to get a chance.
Average SAT to go to UConn this year, 1,300.
Mm.
So
we're going to take a break there. When we come back, we're going to get some of our feats of strength for this week, or maybe we're going to air some grievances with our panelists, Harry Jones, managing editor for Connecticut Public Radio, Mark Pasniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror, Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. In the last couple minutes of the show, we like to Well, search back throughout the course of the past week, maybe look at some things that our panelists are looking at that give them a little bit of strength, or maybe something they want to grumble about. We'll start with Harriet Jones from Connecticut Public Radio. What are you thinking this week, Harriet?
I was told I can't grumble about my broken truck.
You just did. What
no
else you
personal
got?
Automotive grumbles. So, no, I have a feat of strength, and okay, I actually came across a good one for this time of year. I want to commend VITA, the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, which gets ramped up around this time of the year. Which is a fantastic service which will do your tax return for you. If you earn $55,000 or under, this is a service that's available to you free, and as the name suggests, volunteers will help you sit down, do your tax return, find you all kinds of stuff that you didn't know was owed to you, and you know, boost up your return. So if you're one of these people, don't look at the guy spinning the thing outside the strip mall, because he's going to direct you to a service that will take your return away from you,
exactly.
take your refund away from you. But go to VITA. So I think you can go to 211ct.org and find out where there's a VITA site coming to you.
I didn't even know about VITA.
No, that's so cool.
Did you not?
That's
okay.
A really good one.
There you go.
That is a really good feat of strength.
That's a very good feat of strength. Paz, how about you?
A minor grievance.
Okay.
Russell Baker, the great columnist for the New York Times, died yesterday. And the New York Times got beat on the story badly. But that's not the big grievance. The big grievance is... Baker wrote over his life 5,000 columns, and in the very long obituary that the Times had, they linked to only two of them. And, you know, I think Russell Baker was of the school that it's best to show people, not tell, and it would have been nice if the Times had shown us more of his writing, because Baker was of a different era. You know, he wrote more in a whisper than in a shout, which seems to be in vogue today, and it would have been interesting to go back and see how his stuff holds up in this very different age.
Mm, interesting, Colin. Go ahead.
Well, you you blew up my spot.
Oh, no.
It's fine. I still want to say a couple of things about Russell Baker. First of all, when I was in college, I read a Russell Baker column about G. Gordon Liddy, about his Russell Baker's days as an operative with G. Gordon Liddy, which was, of course, completely fabricated and really hilarious. And I thought, I want to do that. I want to do what that guy's doing right now. And I thought, it didn't look that hard either. I bet you I could write something like that. Well, the latter thing turned out to be completely wrong. Russell Baker actually was a sweet, kind, gentle man who helped me a lot in my early days, actually, when I was syndicated by Universal Press Syndicate. He wrote a letter saying, basically in a very funny way, that maybe, you know, newspapers should consider running my column. So, you know, just a cool guy. His sister taught at Miss Porter's for a number of years, so he kind of had some local connections around here, too. So, I was going to do – I don't know whether it's a grievance or a feat of strength, but, you know.
It seems like both, but that's an okay thing.
A little of both, yeah.
Well, I did the grievance. You did the feat of strength.
There we go.
I think that those are both good. I was going to do a different feat of strength, but I'm struck by something. I'm reading in the Connecticut Mirror today a story by Kathy Meegan. You may have seen the headline already. You heard about it on WNPR News today. CCSU, Central Connecticut State University, seeking to fire two professors for alleged sexual misconduct. This is a story that sounds all too familiar at universities around the country, and certainly we've seen a lot of stories like this in the Me Too movement of the last couple of years. So this is a story that's unfolding, Harriet, and we've had some news on it, but the thing that struck me is that this was first reported by The Recorder, the Central Connecticut State
absolutely.
University student newspaper.
Yay, Recorder.
I've worked a lot. I've worked at CCSU. I taught there for 3 years. I know a lot of the people there in the journalism department. I know a lot of people who work on student newspapers. Student newspapers are very underfunded. They're under-resourced. People often aren't teaching them really how to do journalism. And often when they get a chance to do journalism, they run up against the administration. They run up against teachers who don't want to talk to them, who don't want to give them information, who don't want to really let them be journalists or want to censor their work. And The Recorder doesn't always do a great job, just like all sorts of newspapers don't always do a great job. But when they get something right, I think we should really shout it out, Harriet. It's actually making a change. It's having an impact.
Absolutely. And when we first reported this story back when it started last year, you know, the first thing we did was to interview somebody who had reported it for The Recorder. You know, it's just great to see a student newspaper actually having an impact like this. They've really moved the needle on a story.
A shout out to student journalists everywhere. All of us at some point or another, we're student journalists, and it's nice to just see this being recognized in a small way here in Connecticut. I want to thank Harriet Jones, Managing Editor for Connecticut Public Radio. Thank you, Harriet.
You're welcome.
Thanks to Mark Pazniokas, Capital Bureau Chief at the Connecticut Mirror. Thanks so much, Paz.
As always, my pleasure.
And Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show here on WNPR. Thanks so much, Colin.
Thank you, Mr. Dankowski.
Our program is produced by Scott Brady. Our executive producer is Katie Solarski. Kion Wolf is the technical producer. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan for her help today. We'll be back next week with more news on The Wheelhouse.